So when people train these neural networks that are doing such amazing things, they're always kind of doing the same thing. I mean, I could talk about this stuff for hours, but the way that we train neural networks is this really interesting technique that is not the way the brain works, and it's really computationally expensive compared to what a real brain does. So like a human brain uses about 10 watts of electricity. And so since electricity is most of what, when you hear these things about like Microsoft spent, you know, or OpenAI spent $100 million training, you know, GPT-4 or whatever, really that's just paying for electricity, because basically, you know, the two costs of training are the electricity to run the computers and then the depreciable cost of the computers themselves that are doing the training. Okay. And so, and as everybody's been talking about, those are mostly NVIDIA chips today, but they're about to become also AMD and Google TPU chips. You know, there's going to be a bunch of competitors to build fast chips that do neural networks. But when you train a neural network, you basically just pay a huge amount of electricity to do all this training. And a human being trains in a different way, as we all probably intuitively can feel. But, you know, children grow up in having a limited range of experiences, and they have very little electricity they're using, actually, as their brains are running. When a brain runs, it uses about 10 watts of electricity compared to, say, 300 watts for your typical PC at home, or 400 watts a piece for these big cloud GPU computers that we're all talking about. But if you do the math, and it's funny math, a human being trains, say, from 0 to 16, which is the number I did the other day. If you count up what the electric cost of 10 watts for 16 years is, which is, you know, the training time of a teenager, you come up with a number that's like $180. And GPT-3, which was the one that got us all thinking, oh my gosh, something's coming, you know, and then things like Midjourney, GPT-3 cost like $10 million to train. And GPT-4, you know, supposedly maybe $100 million or something. They haven't said, but, you know, lots more than that. And so it's amazing to think that the efficiency of a human growing up and learning about the world is like that, to put it in perspective, that's something like, you know, 10,000 times cheaper than doing it with NVIDIA chips. And so we have a long way, as Richard Feynman said, you know, there's plenty of room at the bottom. Like, we're going to be able to train computers to do the things they're doing today thousands of times cheaper, because we know that the lower bar is set by a human, and we know that humans are not even particularly efficient, although we've evolved very efficient ways to use our neurons. But we're not even, you know, like, computers can probably go even lower once we get, you know, everything working perfectly. So one observation is there's still a long way to go. As someone who's working more directly with people that are doing things like image generation and all these different kinds of neural networks that people are working on, and, you know, sitting here in San Francisco, I'm close to so many of the researchers that are doing next generation stuff on this. I would say that we've got very, very exciting changes that are going to continue to roll through on the AI front. We are not at all at the end of the road on any of this stuff at all. And the idea that, you know, OpenAI's ChatGPT or GPT-4 kind of represents that gives them some stranglehold on our collective future as humans, absolutely not. The innovations are going to continue to come, and they're going to be enormous. And of course, the implications for us as humans are very, very complicated and exciting, and hard to predict.
What's very interesting is you're talking about the computational cost of biology versus silicon, and being able to forecast at least some degree of scale with silicon cost and output. You can also, well, you tell me, you're the expert. It seems to me that you could also project the efficiencies gained to human life and how we can then redirect our effort, our intent, our energy, our thought processes, if much of the tasks that we spend our computational and physical time doing are replicated by some sort of new LLM or sophisticated AI or series of AIs, because it's not just one AI, but a series of AIs. So does that make sense? I know that's kind of a convoluted way of putting it, but like, as the machine becomes more capable, it frees up biological time, and we as humans can then use that time that was there was previously a cost to do other things.
So I think at a high level,
way of looking at it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think at a high level, computers are going to help us do a lot of things now, you know, because they're going to be able to do things like the way we do, right? Which is really cool. I mean, I think the internet, the first 30 years of the internet has mostly been about communication. And now we're entering into a phase where we have a lot of computation available to us with computers. Like, our computers, in a sense, were barely even able to do computation, but they were able to like broadcast videos and stuff. That was cool. That was kind of the first wave. So now we're into the second phase. But what I would say is what you just said, which is reading it back, we're going to be able to do everything we can do with computers. And that's going to mix together with us in some weird way, take jobs away from some of us, create new jobs for others. You know, all these changes are going to come of that. But one important thing that I, you know, is the kind of thing that I think and talk about a lot and have thought a lot for 30 years now. One of the properties of this that's going to be a bit uncomfortable is that these changes are going to come now faster than we have an ability to understand or integrate them. And let me just pause on that, because it's a moment in history that we've never been through, where by comparison, you know, hype curves, for example, you know, the way we adapt to and overuse and then underuse kind of new technologies, we've seen that for a long time, but we've never been in a situation where the rate of change vastly exceeds our ability to understand it. And I know we all feel that right now. I mean, could you really read all the AI news on any given day? Well, as someone who tries to, I can tell you the answer is no. You know, the things that are happening now day to day, where people are trying to apply these remarkable discoveries, you know, with computation to different fields, they're happening too quickly for us to make conceptual sense of, you know, for us to integrate, as one often says. And so I think that's a really deep, troubling, exciting, maybe sometimes inspiring truth that we've got to reckon with now. And I don't know how we do that, but I can recognize, you know, sitting here in San Francisco, that it's important. It's going to be really important, because these changes are coming too quickly now.
So the skeptic in me wants to put context on our timeline, right? So I hear you say that. Look, I've said that as well. And I've said that because I've spent so much time talking to experts like you, like Peter, people 10 times smarter than me, who are deep in the, to extend the metaphor, the heart of this new silicon thing that is happening with AI. And everyone says what you were saying, that the changes that are about to happen will happen so rapidly there isn't precedent. Are we experiencing these changes now? The skeptic, the journalist in me is like, well, when are we going to experience this? Because I remember very recently I was told the metaverse was something that was commercial and happening now. It's a cool idea, but it's happening on a slower timeline than was projected by some people. I remember when crypto was going to change the future of finance, and well, that turned out in a different way. So the skeptic in me, and again, like I'm with you, as someone who has spent time thinking about this space, but I also want to go, well, is this going to happen or is it going to flop?
Well, I think, you know, kind of leaning on that skeptic side, and I agree with you, here are a couple of skeptical observations I would make, for example, about what's going on right now. You know, are we really going to want to chat with that, with AIs? I don't know. I think it's complicated. In other words, so here's what's not complicated. Will they be able to be interesting conversational partners for us? Yes. If you think there's some magic in the way humans listen to and respond to each other, let me just go out on a limb here and say, you're wrong. Come at me on that. There's no way that's going to turn out to be true. However, does that necessarily mean that we as humans are going to want to, you know, have our best friends be AIs? Oh, I'm not sure about that at all. So I think, for example, an appropriate place to be skeptical would be to say, you know, AI chatbots are going to be a trillion-dollar industry, blah, 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 you know, in the following category. I think that's an example of stuff that is way too hard to make predictions about right now. Like why we love things. Look at something like Midjourney, where I'm an advisor. You know, what is art? What compels us to love art? A thought question I ask a lot is, when, if ever, will there be an exhibit at the Met of art created entirely by AI? I think it's a deep question, because the thing is, if you ask the question, is there beautiful art being created by AI? I would only point you to, I don't know, the last 100 images, you know, generated by Midjourney. Like, there's no question.
Look at that Discord, right? Sorry to interrupt you, but right, I'm with you on that. It is compelling, heart-pulling stuff.
Exactly. Like, it's incredible, right? Like, I was so moved by the first few images that David at Midjourney, you know, ever produced, which I had the delight of being able to see before everybody else, you know, and it was so moving because it was like, here is the moment where this thing can paint better than in multiple ways, you know, better than any living human, right? And that was so inspiring to see. However, does that mean that human artists no longer have jobs? I highly doubt that. I don't think that's true at all, because I don't think I would want to see an AI yet. I don't think I would yet want to go to the Met to see an AI artist. And the reason, I guess, vaguely that I personally would say is because I feel like I connect with art because I connect somehow with the struggle of that particular artist. Yeah. That artist has lived some particular life that has some meaning to me. And then I see their art and I say, oh, I understand what you're saying. And so I think that that is an example of where skepticism is appropriate, like you're saying. And I also think it's an example of where we just don't know what happens next. Like, what kind of chat bots will we want to be friends with? We know that they're going to reach the power of our brain and beyond. Like I said, if you hold out hope that there's magic in the human brain that we can't replicate, don't put a whole lot of money on that, because you're going to lose it. But exactly what that means for how things will change, I don't know. And of course, there's a lot of negatives. Like, one I like to beat up on a lot being here in San Francisco is self-driving cars, right? Like, self-driving cars in the short term are going to cause massive negative economic impact, where they're going to take away a whole bunch of jobs. And we don't have any plan on how to replace those jobs. And that is not cool. Like, basically just taking a whole segment of workers and removing their jobs with AI, which, by the way, captures all their income and gives it to like some random company instead of those 10,000, or I think it's 4 million people worldwide that drive cars, you know, for that, you know, drive taxis, drive Ubers, 4 million people. We're going to take away all those jobs. And you should ask, you know, you, Dan, should call and ask the CEOs of those companies what their plan is for a new job for that guy that was driving that car. And I can tell you what their answer is, which is, I have no idea, but, you know, technology has always given us new jobs when it's taken away our old ones. Well, that probably won't be a very satisfying answer for the person who just gave up their job at Uber and is sitting at home. So I think that there are near-term consequences that are very significant and important, and in many cases negative. And we have to, as stewards of, you know, our planet and our species and technology, we need to ride through that in a way that is maximally positive and compassionate for all of us. And we're certainly not doing that right now. We're just saying, hey, get self-driving cars running at any cost. And, you know, if it takes away jobs from people, who cares? Well, you know, I, for one, do care.
You know, that's exactly right. Exactly right. And where there might not be empathy in this statement, or just the, you know, reciting a phrase like, well, technology always replaces jobs and creates new opportunities, you know, that is coming from an insincere place when it's used as a talking point. With you, obviously, you have empathy that extends far beyond a lot of these characters, and you are connected to a group of people who are thinkers, like real thinkers. They're not just your network. They're not just your LinkedIn. Your friends, and maybe not your friends, but the cohort of people you're surrounded with, think about these issues in a way that is substantial, and it is not the same line that we are hearing from pretty entrenched, and not that it's a disingenuous line, but it's a line we've heard for a long time with the entrenched, the mainstream artificial intelligence thinking that's happening. What you were saying is that there will be disruptions, and some of them are going to be more painful than others. We can't just dismiss the human cost.
And I mean, one of the things that I know you read this too, and you've seen this, but, you know, sometimes there'll be like a focal point or a touch point or an event that really kind of brings into sharp contrast the debate or, you know, what the issues are. And I think Marc Andreessen's, what was it called? The Techno-Optimist Manifesto or something of a few weeks ago, that kind of brought that into sharp focus, as has all the discussions around whatever you call it, like effective altruism or accelerationism or whatever those various words. But broadly, the idea there is, don't worry about what the humans think. Just make technology accelerate forward as fast as possible. And someday we'll figure everything else out, because at a very high level, we'll have all these new capabilities that we didn't have before. And I think that is just total garbage. Like, I think the idea that you would just believe that technology will save us is exactly the same as believing in Santa Claus. It has no, there is, you know, any amount of time spent thinking carefully and objectively about that will suggest that there are dragons in making any kind of a simple statement like that, that we're not, you know, we've got all kinds of big near-term challenges. And the idea that you're building something like, we're all just going to live on Mars someday. You know, for example, you know, the most extreme example of that would be, don't worry about climate change on Earth, because, hey, eventually we're all going to be on Mars. And I think that is as dumb a statement. I think most people would agree it's a dumb statement, but there's a lot of statements that look like that, but people aren't seeing how dumb they are. You know, like, AI will save us, just, you know, get the AI turned on and, you know, welcome it and do whatever you can with it as fast as you can and make as much money as you can. And everything will be all right, because, hey, AI is going to, I don't know, cure cancer or something like that. That's just asinine.
Yeah. And there's sinew that connects that to a phrase like, well, a divine being will save us, so don't worry about climate change,
right,
or other changes. And this line has been used throughout history to obfuscate changes that create, yeah, some degree of human harm. You can think about perhaps a metaphor of the railroad, right? Well, it was technology that advanced civilization in many ways, but it also came at a great human cost, because that railroad extended across land that was populated by other human beings that just,
exactly,
didn't have access to that same technology.
And you give a great example there. I think that's a wonderful one to, like, you know, you could lead a conversation about that, right? Which is, yep, technology gave us the railroads. Did that have a benefit to us? Of course it did. It let us move stuff around at a distance, lower costs. That's wonderful. And, you know, people and resources. But could we have done that in a way that was more compassionate relative to its human impact? Of course we could have. Of course we could have. We could have built railroads, you know, lacing themselves all over the world at a lesser negative human impact, right? And the beauty of today is we have even more capacity to do things in a more compassionate way than we did back then. And, you know, as frankly, some of the kind of technology religion people correctly point out, you know, like we have more empathy and compassion and capacity to do good now, but, you know, we need to actually do it. And going back to what you said, yeah, I've written a good bit about this lately on my Substack. And one of the things I basically said was, or I think the name of the article I wrote was, technology is not a religion. I think, like you said, it's just incredibly important. Like I think most people would agree, technology is not a religion. So don't treat it like one. It's not an unvarnished good. There's not a deity that is the deity of technology that we can appeal to. That's just all nonsense. We own this problem. And, you know, just, you know, varnishing technology with "it's always good" is just a very bad way to move forward.
Well, just to wrap this back to how you opened this conversation, you've spent a lot of time with your cohort of friends and contacts thinking about these advancements in artificial intelligence. And just to pair it back to you, by orders of magnitude, the change that is about to happen, or that is likely to happen, could happen, is pretty significant. When and why and what do we do next? Not small questions, I know.
Well, I think some guidelines that you've heard me say before, I think, is one is that there is a metric that we can use, that which is, are we kind of increasing our trust in and connection to each other by our use of technology? I think that that metric, and by the way, you can like do a survey to measure that. Like you can make that a number. You can make that like GDP. That metric of like, do you feel more trusting of and connected to your other humans? That's the, first of all, that's the needle we ought to be moving in the positive direction. And we can use AI, to give an example, as a chatbot. We can use AI to make us better conversation partners or better life partners for other humans. We can do that. And then we can even measure the outcome of that. But we have to choose, and will AIs do that? Totally. And I say this, my wife is a therapist. And so I guess I can say at least that I've had some vigorous, smart arguments about this, you know, like she, you know, she knows more about the ability of an AI in some sense to improve our, you know, condition as humans than I do. And there's no question but that's going to happen. You know, AIs could, for example, be the therapy that we all, so everybody needs therapists. I mean, yeah, you know, fall therapy, but everybody needs a therapist, especially right now. But therapists aren't, especially in the United States, at least, therapists aren't covered by insurance. And so basically nobody has a therapist, but everybody needs one. Could AIs be the therapist for us, or kind of help us, you know, kind of help us even get more excited about having a therapist? Yeah, I think so. So that's a good example. But we gotta measure these things carefully and then move, you know, in the positive direction.